question. I think did somebody have a comment? I'll be quiet if so.
I guess I can speak to that. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yep.
You know, the fact is, provided they do it properly, if we assume that this is a rule of procedure, the legislature can amend our rules of procedure. I think that's the main reason why I think really cooperation is our only option. Now, I did want to ask a question. Ron, remind me of the history of the Green Phase Working Group. Didn't they initially have recommendations as to certain kinds of proceedings that would be presumptively virtual?
It did not. It indicated that that was likely the case, that there would be some that would be more amenable to being held remotely than others. And then in the end, only ended up recommending factors that judges should consider when making a decision about whether to hold a given hearing in person or remotely. And that is ultimately what the Judicial Council adopted from that report as well.
So even in the early stages, they didn't have a list of presumptively virtual hearings that was developed?
I gave them a list. I gave them several lists to consider that were taken from other states. So they did look at those. They came to some conclusions such as, if we're going to make a recommendation, they would have recommended if there were any presumptions that there'd be no presumptions applied in juvenile court. That was one of the things that the committee wanted to recommend. But they did not want to follow that path of adopting a list or even recommending a list.
Yeah, I know that's how they eventually came out. I'm speaking to Judge Barnes's point here for a minute. I think we, you know, in the court, I think we really have to collaborate. And two, we need a concrete list, I think, of proceedings that we are willing to agree should be presumptively virtual. And I don't know if any of the spade work has been done on that in the course of the committee's work, even though I know they didn't ultimately recommend that. But regardless of the jurisdictional question, and there are, I think there are areas of overlap between the council and the Supreme Court, but regardless, even independent of the jurisdictional issue, I know the Supreme Court would certainly welcome, and I also think the Judicial Council would certainly welcome someone or a group sitting down and developing, and this had to be obviously have to be done quickly, developing a list of proceedings that we are comfortable we can say should be presumptively virtual. You know, something we can use and that can direct Michael in the course of his negotiations with the legislature. And Ron, you're telling me that at least as far as the Green Phase Working Group goes, that was not done.
That's correct, Chief. I shared with them four examples from four other jurisdictions that had done that. They did not elect to do that.
And Chief, I know that your Advisory Committee on the Rules of Civil Procedure grappled with that specific question on December 6th, and I believe they formulated a list at that meeting. I don't know if it's been communicated back to the court yet, because I don't know if there's been an opportunity for them to be on court conference. I imagine that the other advisory committees may have engaged in a similar process. Some of the attorneys that staff those committees are present in the meeting. They may have more information, Bryson and Keisa and Stacy.
Yeah, let's turn to them. Where does that stand?
Well, Chief, I can start with the rules of civil procedure. This is Stacy. Sorry, Bryson, didn't mean to cut you off. The committee did talk at length. They took their entire meeting in December to talk about this issue. And they've talked about it before, and they have a subcommittee working on amendments to Rule 7. But kind of the guiding light that the committee kept coming back to was the party's preference. And so a presumption for the party's preference when it comes to all dispositive motions is what they talked about. They talked about a presumption for in-person hearings when it comes to trials and evidentiary hearings, and then a presumption for remote hearings for a lot of other issues, pro se calendars, status conferences, Rule 16 conferences, statement of discovery issues, which I think is already in Rule 7 or 37, and then domestic case management conferences. But those are the main hearing types that they discussed at their meeting in December.
Thank you, Stacy. Rising.
For the Criminal Procedure Committee, 17.5 is in subcommittee right now. But I think to answer your question more directly, if we were to limit the scope of the question to just a list of presumptively in-person versus virtual proceedings, it would take one committee meeting for our committee to make that determination and provide that list to the court. What we're dealing with right now in subcommittee is the nuances around what happens when someone disagrees with that presumption and that person is a judge, or if they're a party, or if they're a victim, and some of the procedures around making motions or objections and the timelines that complicate that. So if that's what the court would like is a list, I certainly believe we could provide that at our next committee meeting, which will be in February.
Yeah, what is everyone about that? I don't think we have the luxury anymore of not having a very concrete, specific list of proceedings or categories of proceedings that we're willing to agree should be presumptively virtual. Let me just throw it out to the group for thoughts on that.
I think that's probably right. I mean, if we don't have one, we'll be given one.
Exactly.
Judge Farr?
Yeah, thank you. And I agree with that as well. My concern as I read through this bill was the exceptions, right? I generally agree with even the direction the legislation is going by having substantive and non-substantive. I think a list makes a lot of sense. My concerns were all the exceptions. What if somebody doesn't have the ability to join us by internet because they don't have the technology, or, you know, what if, you know, it's those one-offs and the exceptions. That's where I think we would need to spend a lot of time and make sure we have provisions for those individuals. I mean, I think I have been very accommodating to the parties and really have, just based on party preferences. I have WebEx hearings, I have in-person, a party can appear on whatever they want. This rule would make it more restrictive where I couldn't accommodate some of the needs and requests of the parties. And so I would just like to see something built in where we can more easily address those other situations.
Stacy.
That's a good point.
Drawing from what the judge just said, the other thing, another big issue that the Civil Rules Committee discussed was if a party desires to attend in person, whether or not it's presumptively remote or in person, they should have the ability to do so. They talked about having the right to do so, but they didn't like that language. But the ability to come to the court if they feel like they want to be there or they don't have the ability to attend remotely, that the court should always be available for those people if they want to attend a hearing in person.
I ask a question. So at the Judicial Council's last meeting, the council instructed me to reconvene the Green Phase Working Group, which we've now started calling the Virtual Hearings Working Group. The timing on all this is not great, obviously. Do you want any feedback from that group? Their first meeting is scheduled on February 8th. In addition to judges and staff, we also have representatives from the Utah State Bar, Utah Legal Services, Timpanogos Legal Center, Access to Justice Commission, and the Disability Law Center.
Would that group be able to have knowledge about the proposed bill and what the legislature's input is? Because I think that definitely would sway the decisions of some people if they know here's the consequence if we don't come up with something. So could that be shared?
It'll be numbered before then. Okay. I'm guessing this bill will get numbered sometime this week. And I should call it a joint resolution, but yeah, this piece of legislation will be numbered this week, almost certainly. And so yeah, it'll be public at that point. I think waiting until the 8th to have the conversation with them is a long time in legislative half-lives, right? In terms of 5 weeks of session, and that's 10 days away. But, and I also think that advisory group needs to know what piece of this puzzle is theirs to solve. And so again, I think we circle back to having a conversation about who has responsibility for making what decisions in this space between the court and the council, so that people can focus their attention on the part that is actually theirs to help solve, if that makes sense. We'll help focus efforts to know.
What we're looking for today is a, for our record purposes, a formal vote of the council on how to move forward. It doesn't need to be overly specific, but we need to have, it's on for action today. We need to have the direction that we give to Michael be by way of a vote. So we're looking for a motion.
What would this motion say? What do we mean?
Can I put some things out there for consideration?
Which out there?
We have Michael's put some things for consideration.
Well, if I had my druthers, and I often don't, I might say something like it is the position of the Judicial Council that the council collaborate with the legislators who are interested in this project, that the council reach out to the Supreme Court through the Rule 3105 process as quickly as possible, hopefully sometime this week, and have the management committee and a designee of the Supreme Court talk about the division of responsibility for rulemaking in this area and make some decisions about what the various entities, the court and the council, are going to be focusing on through their advisory committee processes or whatever. I would then also hope that a motion might give some direction as to which part of this problem we're focused most on. If the council wants to really try and solve the presumption about who can attend remotely and a pathway or a vehicle for making a low friction switch to what the presumption is, whether it's through a motion that can be decided without full briefing or whether it's even just notice to the court in some way, and ask if the legislators would be open to focusing on that part of the problem instead of trying to solve the whole thing, including all substantive matters. Those sort of directions articulated to me in a motion would be very helpful if that's the direction people want to go.
Judge Tarita?
I just have a question. I'm focusing on this rule 3105, and I was just reading, and it said, to the extent matters arise or come before the Judicial Council that are within the exclusive authority of the Supreme Court, the Judicial Council shall refer all such matters to the Supreme Court by notice to the Chief Justice. Are we saying that this is not a rule of, that this is not, these are not rules of procedure and therefore within the exclusive authority of the Supreme Court? I understand the legislature can do what it can do by virtue of its 2/3 vote. I'm just confused by the fact that all of this falls within the rules of procedure, whether civil or criminal. And yet,
that's a great, great question. I mean, if push comes to shove, and we've communicated about this as a court, and Paige, you can weigh in on this. If push comes to shove, I would be hard pressed to argue that these proposed changes are not procedural. They seem pretty darn procedural. So, you know, we can, now I'm just one voice, but Paige, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, so I think that definitely some members of the court see it as all procedural. And I think a list of presumptions for hearing type sounds quite procedural. My hesitation on saying it's all procedural, so I think there is definitely some procedure, but my hesitation on saying it's only procedure is that a lot of these issues. So I've tried to make a list of what I think we need to, what will feed into the final decision on this. And one of them is list of presumptions based on hearing type. That seems procedural to me, but some of it seems like just court scheduling, the kind of stuff that judges do, you know, day in and day out with their schedules between them and the parties. So party and lawyer preference, that is probably as important as hearing type. It needs to be functional and efficient for the judge. There's kind of this, you know, a question of, okay, I've got to set my criminal calendar. What do I need functionally and working with the jail for this to be able to work? The effect on third parties like jails and prisons, and that this needs to be workable for unrepresented litigants, as well as lawyers who have access to, you know, more access to our rules. So some of those to me seem like not the kind of thing that our rules committees look at. It's the kind of thing that the AOC would normally dig into and try to figure out. So to the extent that it's just scheduling and efficiency and functionality, that seems more like an administrative project. To the extent that we end up with a list of presumptions based on hearing types, that seems more like a procedural rule. So I guess my bottom line is I think there are aspects of both in this. But that I'm only speaking for myself, and some of my colleagues may not agree on that.
Judge Lowe?
Yeah, I wanted to echo the latter part of what Justice Peterson said. When it feels like something that my clerk does, then it really just feels administrative. And coordinating with jails and prisons, taking into account the nature of the hearing, the nature of the case, and the preferences of the parties is something that my clerk does. She schedules those things. And when you consider also the vast swaths of interests that are involved, from probate cases that are so unique, adoption cases, domestic cases, eviction cases, you notice that a special interest has been able to accept out eviction hearings from being evidentiary hearings because it's unique. There are unique aspects to every kind of case we do. And I can't remember how many different kinds of cases are in the clerk system. I think there's a neighborhood of 30 to 50, somewhere in that neighborhood. And each one of those has a wide variety of types of hearings that have evolved to serve the parties. And we've always been urged, I think back from Justice Durant's presentation to the judicial conference over a year ago, was to take into account the needs of the parties. And when we start delving into fiat rules that just become the default situation, even if it's predictable, it can end up not serving well the parties. So in my feeling is this is mostly administrative. That would give rise to some rules of civil procedure regarding how to change a court's scheduling of something. If a motion is required or something else is required, I could see that being a rule of civil or criminal procedure. But my sense, my flavor, I don't know what to base it on other than it's something that my clerk does, is that most of this is administrative. And to try to bite off anything in the next few weeks and chew it well is going to end up with some really bad legislation. That may be inevitable, but that's my feeling now. Thank you.
I have wondered along those lines, Judge Lowe, how much of this is just scheduling? And I don't know in each chambers how judges do their scheduling, but to the extent that a JA is calling the parties and saying, hey, when can we put this matter on? And asking the parties, do you want to be remote or in person? That's pretty good customer service, right? Like you're getting asked personally how you want to appear, and things are being scheduled in that way. I don't know how often that's how scheduling works, but.
Well, and just speaking again to the criminal stuff, because I'm so freaked out about it, but for most of COVID, Judge Curris, as presiding judge here, was the master scheduler for WebEx slots at the ADC all over the state. So if you wanted a time slot, the ADC to see someone in custody, you had to go through Judge Curtis. He had a spreadsheet like you wouldn't believe. The ADC has since taken that over, but part of the reason they can do that now is because they're not, they bring people. They don't, but they don't have, I mean, the scheduling complication to have in custodies, mostly by WebEx, some brought statewide from somewhere like the ADC. I mean, in my view, that's 100% administrative. This is so complicated scheduling wise.
I guess that is one question. To what extent is this solved by hearing type and presumptions? And to what extent is this just making sure that in scheduling, party preference and lawyer preference gets consideration so they can say if they can appear or not?
Seems like we need to sort that out.
Yeah.
I just to speak to this, whether it's a council issue or the Supreme Court, I think our vote today isn't trampling on that. Our vote is, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, that hopefully the motion would be the position that the council is going to take. The reason this is coming from liaison is they were troubled taking a position. Am I right?
Yes.
Without talking to the full council. So when we say, you know, we're going to collaborate, implicit in that is if it's the Supreme Court's bailiwick, then we would just be referring it to them as part of the collaboration process. I just want to make at least my understanding clear that we're just talking about the position that the council is going to take on behalf of the courts.
What if, okay.
Legislation, right?
Yes. Let me try a motion.
Well, we got, can I?
Do we have a motion?
No, we don't. I saw a hand. Judge Farr.
Yeah, I was going to attempt, but Justice Peterson, if you'd prefer, you can.
Well, you go for it.
All right. I will move that the council take the position to collaborate with the legislature on the proposed joint resolution and also to convene a meeting between the management committee and a representative of the Supreme Court to address jurisdictional issues.
That was perfect. I will second that.
Any further discussion? See no golden hands on the screen, no hands here in the room. I'll call for a vote. All those in favor say aye or raise your thumbs.
Aye.
Any nay votes? Seeing none, hearing none, that passes. Final question, at least. There might be others. Michael, do you need anything else from us?
Just your undying support. No, I'm good. Thank you. I appreciate everything that you all do.
Thank you so much for making yourselves available today. Did we have a question up there? Sorry.
I had a question. I'm sorry. And maybe this is too far into the weeds for future discussions. But, Michael, one thing, and I think this goes, the pendulum would be swinging the direction the legislators want it to swing. But as I looked at this, asking pro se litigants on an infraction to file a written motion to have their hearings that might be substantive done virtually, it seems cumbersome to me. I mean, I have people on speeding tickets and all over justice courts throughout the state. They'd rather do a trial even virtually. And, you know, even though evidence is taken and witnesses are sworn, if there was a way to maybe carve out infractions or something, and even instead of requiring a written motion, particularly on a criminal calendar, I imagine this is true in the district court as well, at least practiced there as an attorney for a while. If you allowed for an oral motion at the hearing where we're scheduling the next hearing, that might promote some efficiency as well, so that they can just, you know, make that request right there in open court for which direction they want to go if it's contrary to the presumption.
I have one.
I agree with Judge Brower, because also you have all those emergency things that come up. The day of court, your DA has COVID or your defense attorney has COVID or something like that. Nobody has time to do written motions if you have a full calendar. That having a way for a motion, I think, is appropriate, but to require it to be written, I think, is too much of a burden on a lot of people.
Justice Peterson?
Just one quick thing. So with this, the 3105 process, can we make it a, in the vein of a rapid response process like we've done with our rules committees? We've sent, we kind of, during the legislative session, when the legislature is proposing a rule and we want to be involved, we'll kind of have a smaller group from a rules committee act in a rapid response format. So maybe this group can do that.
That would be a great idea. And we know who the members of the management committee are. We would just need the Supreme Court to let us know who they want to participate.
Okay. All right.
Anything else? Thank you again for being so flexible to meet on such short notice, and y'all have a good day.